on death. For NPR News, I'm Shannon Novak in Miami.
Alaska Senator Ted Stevens is facing a problem from within the Republican Party. Stevens was convicted last month of 7 corruption felonies and still doesn't know if he has won re-election. Now, a fellow Republican senator says he'll push to have Stevens expelled from the GOP conference. The action could come during a meeting next week to elect party leaders for the next session of Congress. Stevens could also be stripped of prime committee assignments. He has already lost his ranking positions on 2 committees. Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell says if Stevens' convictions are upheld on appeal, he will support expelling him from the Senate. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Department of Homeland Security, offering E-Verify, confirming the legal working status of new hires at dhs.gov/e-verify.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Bah Humbug Productions, presenting their second annual production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol at Parkland College. Adaptation by Nick Schneider with original music by Tim Schirmer. Performances are December 5th through 21st. Ticket information and reservations at 351-2528.
Well, good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. So how did you sleep last night? Well, if your answer is, well, not well or not enough, you have a lot of company. In fact, according to the National Sleep Foundation, 65% of Americans report some sleep problems. Either they have trouble falling asleep or they wake up during the night, or when they wake up in the morning, they say that they are still tired. Now, there is some good news here, and that is that we understand sleep and sleep disorders much better than we did just a few years ago, and there is help available for people who have difficulty sleeping. This morning, we have 2 guests with us here. Both of them work at the Regional Sleep Disorders Center at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Dr. Charles Davies, he is a neurologist, and Dr. Keith White, he is a psychologist. And between them, I'm sure that we're in a position to answer a lot of questions. And the thing that we always say when we have physicians here on the program is we want to make sure people understand we cannot do diagnosis over the phone, because the doctors cannot see you, but we do these shows to try to give people a chance to ask questions and get basic information, and then if you have concerns, of course, you want to pursue that with your own physician. But I don't want to discourage anyone from calling. I'm sure that the 2 guests will do their best to give you an answer. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Thanks. Good morning, David. I'm Dr. Davies, Chip Davies, and thanks a lot for having us.
Good. And Dr. White.
Yes, delighted to be here. Thank you very much.
You know, I was looking at the results of this recent survey by the National – it was actually done for the Sleep Foundation, the National Sleep Foundation, and the results they put them out last spring. And they found, for example, of the people that they surveyed, they said 29% said that they fell asleep or became very sleepy at work in the past month. 14% said they'd missed family events, work functions, or leisure activities in the past month because of sleepiness. And this is the one that really scares me. 36% said that they had nodded off or fallen asleep while driving. And of course, I'm sure that there are people who in their work maybe work around heavy equipment or do something that's dangerous. So definitely you want to make sure that people are alert. And it seems to me that survey after survey shows that significant numbers of Americans say that they are tired and that they're not getting good sleep or not getting enough sleep. Is this, do you think, a more serious problem than it has been in the past?
I think, David, that it's being recognized more recently. Of course, we have to keep in mind that, you know, in our very busy society today, there are more things to take our time. And actually, Dr. White and I were just talking about this, that, you know, everybody gets there's a tendency and a pressure to get over-programmed. And so actually the things you mentioned are certainly major concerns, not just health concerns, but public safety concerns with the issue with nodding off at the wheel or at work. So the first thing we always like to step back and ask is, are you getting enough sleep? And so in general, for adults, we recommend that they have at least 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night. And actually, there's more data emerging now that if you get less than that, it's not just going to make you more sleepy, perhaps, and cause some of the dangers that we talked about, but there may be additional health risks. For example, there was a study that looked at people who get fewer than 6 hours of sleep per night, and there is actually an increased risk, about maybe a 30 or 40% increased risk of hypertension for people that consistently obtain fewer than 6 hours of sleep per night.
Yeah. And certainly there is a strong relationship between whether you get enough sleep and whether you feel well-rested and mood.
Oh, absolutely. Sleep is a critical component to human existence, and we may want to cut it off a bit because we want to do this or that, as Dr. Davies has suggested. But it will take a pretty quick toll on mood, attitude, resilience in the face of stress. And so everything will actually become more difficult, even just slightly. And that can actually increase our need for sleep. But then if we sleep even less or a small amount, it becomes a vicious downward spiral that can take a mental as well as physical toll.
Mm. Well, do you think that it is the case that we're coming to this point or increasingly have come to this point where there are only so many hours in the day and we're trying to – people are working longer. They have to try to take care of family commitments. They're trying to do more. And so they're allowing themselves less time for sleep, or there is less time for sleep. That it's is it more that, or is it also that people, for whatever reason, when they do sleep or when they do try to sleep, they're having difficulty with getting to sleep or getting good quality sleep?
I think, yeah, there's a yes answer to both of those questions, a component of that. And some studies have suggested that, of course, since the turn of the last century, with all of the electronic gadgetry now that we have and toys and things to occupy our time after the sun goes down, that it's estimated that people are getting on average about an hour less sleep than they did, you know, let's say in the year 1900. And so that's certainly one issue. And then the other issue, which I'm sure Dr. White can add to, is that, yes, when the other thing problem is that when you not only don't allow yourself enough time to sleep, but don't allow yourself enough time to unwind. When you have people in the situation of, let's say they're doing emails in bed, you know, reading email and you know, right before they go to sleep, well, you know, you don't know what's at the other end of that email. Maybe it's stressful. Maybe it could keep you up for another half hour or 45 minutes or so.
Certainly, I'm hearing quite a bit that folks are using their email, searching the web, returning calls very, very late in the evening after maybe coming home after work, taking care of family obligations, going right back to work in a sense without actually going to the office, working all evening, and then basically in too many cases, even though they know it's not that logical, hoping to flip off the light and fall asleep. And really, it's very difficult to disengage that quickly for many of us, if not most of us, to just sort of turn off our minds and fall asleep into a deep, restful sleep. And so I'm routinely recommending, maybe to the chagrin of some of my patients, that they take a much longer wind down period in the evening. And typically in America, folks are using the television quite a bit to wind down. But there's a fair degree of evidence to say that this does not sort of really give everybody the wind down they need. The mood changes and the relaxation effect that would be more beneficial for them falling asleep. And so there's some real challenges in our modern society to getting to sleep and staying asleep. Mm. Some people can fall asleep pretty readily and they're zonked out for an hour or two and then they're awake and they're really awake and they really struggle in the wee hours to get back to sleep.
Mm. Well, just you talked, Dr. Davies talked about the fact that you think that on average, probably most people, it would be good if they could get 7 to 8 hours of good sleep every night. And I'm sure that people maybe know or have heard of people who say, oh, well, really, I could get by on 2 or 3. Is that really true? Is there that much variability in the average amount of sleep that people need?
like everything in, you know, in biology, there's essentially a bell curve. There's a spread, and so yes, there are those lucky few people that I wouldn't go so far as to say 2 hours. I mean, I guess you hear the myths and the legends about, you know, Leonardo da Vinci only needed to sleep, you know, let's say 30 minutes at a time, and he slept for, you know, 5 hours a day or something like that. I mean, there are some people that are very lucky. You know, they're on the very end of that curve, the tail of that bell curve, that may be able to do well with 5 hours of sleep. I've never come across somebody who could get by on 2 hours of sleep. And then there's the people that need, you know, more like 9 hours of sleep. But I would say that those people are few and far between, very small percent. You know, let's say maybe 1% of the population can get by on 5 hours or so. And likewise, you know, 1% perhaps needs, you know, 9 or 10 hours of sleep a night.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that a lot of parents maybe are amazed and somewhat exasperated perhaps about their children's capacity for sleep, particularly adolescents. And I think one of the things that we have come to appreciate is the fact that, yes, there are certain stages in life. We're used to this idea that infants sleep a lot, but that there are other stages in life when people are going to need more sleep. And it sounds as if, I think it is true, that that period, that adolescence, is actually a time when people do need more sleep.
Absolutely. I mentioned the figure for adults. Certainly for children, let's say around the age of 10, they should be getting closer to about 9 or 10 hours of sleep a night. And then in the early teen years, certainly around, 9 and a half hours of sleep a night. And then the later teen years, 8.5 to 9, it kind of gradually levels off. But those sleep requirements are so critical for the development of the young mind. And that can impact on school and learning and learning how to learn, you know, a skill that people can that have to rely on for the rest of their lives.
So by the same token, I'm sure that older people say that they do not sleep maybe as well as they once did or have difficulty sleeping, and that it probably may be at around 50, maybe a little bit later, I suppose, you know, it depends on who it is, that people may be starting to say things like, well, you know, I don't sleep as well as I did. What happens to sleep as people get into the older age groups?
Well, So sleep is – I'll step back a second and just give a little primer on – so sleep architecture is composed of four stages and then REM sleep. And REM sleep is the so-called dreaming sleep. Contrary to what a popular notion, REM sleep is not the most critical sleep that we need. It's actually slow wave sleep, stage 3 and 4, when the brain waves really slow down. And that percentage of sleep is usually about 12 to 15 maybe 18% of the night. That does tend to decrease as people age. And actually women maintain a little more of it than men in older age. I've seen some patients who have the rare patient who has no slow wave sleep, and they do okay. And I guess I would submit that we don't fully understand that. But in general, slow wave sleep is necessary. But then there are other medical issues that may come into play as people get older, arthritis, and there is data to suggest that women, when they reach postmenopausal age, that sleep can certainly be disrupted and fragmented by hot flashes and other things. So I wouldn't say that people need less sleep necessarily as they age, but that other things can impact on their sleep.
Okay. Let me just very quickly introduce again both guests, because we might have some folks who have just tuned in. The last person you heard, that's Dr. Charles Davies. He's a neurologist. He works at the Carle Foundation Hospital Regional Sleep Disorders Center in Urbana. And also here is Dr. Keith White. He is a PhD doctor. He is a psychologist. Also there works at the Sleep Disorders Center. And we're here talking about sleep and sleep issues. And if you have questions, certainly give us a call, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think I might have jumped in on you. Were you wanting to add something on to this sort of general discussion about sleep and age?
Oh, sure. Happy to. In terms of teenagers, I think Dr. Davies will confirm this. We often see a sleep phase shift, and not to be too technical, but it just means that teens are often wanting to wind down and go to sleep later. This is very natural and very normal. And of course, if we ask them to get up early for school, we may cut into what might be their natural rhythm, even though they do very much need sleep for brain development, learning, but also for to deal with all the psychological and social pressures of this very challenging time. So it's a challenge for parents. I have a couple of teenagers, and it is a challenge, I'd say, to get them to want to go to bed at what might be a more reasonable time as compared to their wake time so that they get sufficient sleep, as Dr. Davies has said. And then with respect to the older folks that I see, something that starts to play in for people from the psychological standpoint is that they begin to fear that they're not getting enough sleep, and they become sort of hyper-focused on how much or little sleep they get. And when our mental resources are down at night and we wake up, a great deal of people report to me, they look at the clock, they very quickly calculate how much sleep they've had, how much they're still going to get before the alarm goes off. They start thinking about what they have to do the next day, and all of those things interfere with actually being in a rested state so sleep can take you back over. So there are some real challenges that Dr. Davies and I see that if people will practice some regular things can make it easier. There are no guarantees, but certainly we seem to help people, at least some people, get some better sleep.
Yeah, okay. Well, we can certainly I have a couple of callers here I want to get to, but certainly I'm sure that you would both like to run down that very basic list of things that people can do, sort of sleep hygiene, I guess it's sometimes called, you know, sort of really basic things that can help if people are having difficulty. So, well, I'm sure we'll do that, and we'll take as many questions as people would like to pose. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have two callers here ready to go, and the first is in Urbana in line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
This may sound a little off the wall, but I wonder if there have ever been any studies done on sleep disorders that run in families.
Yes, there have. In fact, something that David and Dr. White were just touching on, Dr. White expanded on, the delayed sleep phase that we often see in teenagers, that does run in families. And in fact, its counterpart, advanced sleep phase, which typically we see more in older individuals, that can run in families as well. So yes, those are two examples of conditions that can be inherited.
Really?
Yes, absolutely.
That's very interesting. My sister and I are both in our 60s, and we have had this problem for years. We can invariably, even though we live miles and miles apart, we invariably wake up between 1:30 and 2 in the morning. I never really go back to sleep. I sort of doze. I'm awake again about 4, so is she. And at that point, she usually just gets up. I don't. And now her daughter, who's 30-something, has the same problem at the same times, and now her 8-year-old grandson is developing them. And I just thought, this is really strange. But that is an inherited thing.
It can't. Yes, absolutely.
Oh,
and from what you're describing, it certainly sounds like your family would fall into that category. They're working on it. Recently, they have isolated one of the genes that's involved with that. And, you know, that information may not, you know, directly benefit you right now. But all I can say is that, you know, with more information and further studies, hopefully we can further understand the mechanisms of those symptoms and phenomena and someday help.
That's very interesting. Thank you very much.
All right.
Certainly.
Thank you. We'll continue. And the next caller here is someone here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, line two. Hello.
Hi. I was listening this morning, and it was a subject that I had a few issues with. I'm 21 years old, and I work two jobs for about 15 hours a day, and my mom seems to think that, you know, I'm burning the candle at both ends type of thing, not getting enough sleep, not getting enough nourishment. On the other hand, my father tells me that it's good for me because, you know, I'm young and I'm able to do this. But yet, I mean, every morning I find myself just yearning for that extra 10 minutes, you know, hit the sleep button on the alarm clock. Is this very unhealthy for me because I just feel tired all the time? And
well, I think, yes, that if you're, I guess as we talked, as we discussed more at the top of the show, you should be getting at least 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night. Definitely sleep deprivation, chronic sleep deprivation, can cause problems with concentration and actually even fine motor, quick motor ability, things like that, and memory as well. So in addition to making you feel sleepy all the time. So, I would guess I would have to side with your mother in this instance that if you're not getting at least 7 hours of sleep a night, I would bump it up to that and see how you feel.
Okay, I appreciate it.
All right, thank you. And another caller here. This is someone in Champaign and line three. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hi. I'm a person in my 60s who certainly doesn't sleep the way I slept when I was younger, and I often wake up, between 3 and 4. But I'm also trained to teach stress reduction techniques, and I have learned that, and I this is what I do, and I'm just curious if anybody's, probably somebody's researched it, that when I use my relaxation methods and I put myself into a state of deep relaxation for an hour or so at that early hour of the morning, one thing is it certainly counterbalances the tendency to start what you were talking about before, do the worrying and counting the hours and worrying if I'm going to get enough sleep and if I'm going to be tired, et cetera. But, I mean, it seems to me that that hour of deep relaxation makes up for several hours of sleep that I didn't get, and I was just curious about that.
Well, I will chime in on that. This is Dr. White, the sleep psychologist. I am not certain that I could point to the research evidence that says that there'd be a trade-off that you could actually make up for the sleep with the deep relaxation. They are slightly different states as far as I understand them. And yet, what an excellent strategy to be using if, in fact, you aren't sleeping. We find that in a whole host of positive ways, those very deep relaxing states which you teach and you've been able to learn yourself and utilize are excellent and quite helpful to you. And we would certainly recommend that you continue to use that. And yet, in line with what Dr. Davies has said, if you feel you aren't getting enough sleep overnight, it might be important to speak to someone because...
I'm sorry, I didn't get what you just said.
Oh, if you aren't getting enough sleep overnight,
uh-huh.
It might be helpful to speak to someone about that because we'd certainly like to see people getting 7 hours sleep, 8 hours sleep if they possibly could, because that's ultimately how most of us are built and what most of us need. But the relaxation is absolutely an excellent thing to do. I certainly wish many more people would do it. But I can't point to any research that really says that it makes up for sleep per se. But if Dr. Davies knows of some, I'm certainly turn it over to him.
I'm not aware of any. No, I agree that you need to try and have those hours of sleep.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, let me just for a moment ask you then to talk some more about this specific problem, and then we have some other callers we get back to. For people who would say, I don't have any difficulty falling asleep, no problem there, but the thing is I fall asleep and maybe I sleep for an hour or two, and then I wake up and I'm wide awake. And it seems like, it's I lay there in bed and I toss and turn. And I'm sure that there are some people who say that the longer that goes on, as you say, the more you worry, oh, my gosh, I'm not sleeping. I'm going to be exhausted. You look at the clock and it's 2:30 and then it's 2:45 and then it's 3:00 and then it's 3:15. You know how you can get into that. And the more you sort of worry about that, the more you get yourself kind of all tense. And that I'm sure that works against being able to relax and sleep. Somebody who has that kind of issue, who frequently wakes up early in the morning, in the middle of the night, can't get back to sleep, what sort of things do you suggest?
Well, first off, you always want to make sure that you explore or that if there's any other symptom going on, in other words, what's causing you to wake up, I guess that would be the first question to ask. And if people are waking up gasping, short of breath, choking, things like that, that might – and if some other bed partner observes them snoring, then that might suggest obstructive sleep apnea. So that some people wake up in the middle of the night because of that. if they're not having that, which is which would fall more into the category of the of sleep, what we call sleep maintenance insomnia. There are certainly, and you touched on the phrase which we use all the sleep hygiene. There are definitely tried and true strategies for improving sleep hygiene. And what can happen is people, although they're their goal is they want to, you know, they want to have better sleep, they want to get adequate hours of sleep, they may fall into these traps or fall into habits that can actually perpetuate the insomnia, such as Dr. White said, looking at the clock. Maybe they might not sleep enough hours the night before. So then they think, well, I need to get more sleep tonight, so I'll get in bed at 8:30 instead of 10. And then they may just lay in bed, you know, not sleeping, and that just – that exacerbates it because, as Dr. White mentioned, it's not just a matter of flipping off a switch that you – it's you have to wind down. You have to have the right mindset to be able to sleep. And I'll let Dr. White jump in here on some of these strategies.
Sure. I might add something about specifically about sleep. I think as far as we understand at this point, there are a number of mechanisms that help us fall asleep and keep us asleep during the night. And one of those is the sleep drive. And that builds during the day and gets stronger and stronger. And then we fall asleep. But that sleep drive is made up in about the first third of our total sleep time. Overnight. And so then folks who have a lot on their mind may have pain, may have stress, may have external disturbances or a physical symptom of some type are going to be potentially more easily awakened after their sleep drive has been made up, meaning they've made up that need based on that particular drive. Now, there are other mechanisms that keep us asleep, and we want to not interfere with those. Mm-hmm. And so there are some specific strategies that we recommend. We tailor those to the individual, David, looking at a sleep log and analyzing it and looking at their whole medical picture to make sure that we're giving good recommendations. But if it comes down to the recommendations I make, we may have a person decrease the amount of time they spend in bed, because if they're spending time in bed and not sleeping, certainly more than 30 minutes a night that they're not sleeping but laying in bed, they're actually hurting themselves in some ways because they're associating in their brain their bed with not sleeping rather than their bed being associated with sleeping. So we ask them to get up, go to someplace else in the house, relax, and when they feel drowsy, to go back to bed. That's called stimulus control specifically. But so we ask people to do that. We look at how much time they should actually spend in bed. And we really, from my perspective, push the wind down, the relaxation, and perhaps doing that in the middle of the night as well.
Yeah, okay. And certainly it's one of the basic things, and you touched on it, and all the sort of lists of things to do, you always suggest to people try to go to sleep at the same time, get up at the same time. Mm-hmm. Don't take your laptop into bed with you and be doing work. It's probably, you know, maybe not a good idea to have a television there, other sorts of things. The bed ought to be for sleeping in, and, you know, what else you might want to do there. Not for doing work, not really a place that you watch television, not for those other sorts of things. You want in people's minds, you want to associate being in bed with sleeping and not with any of that other activity.
Absolutely. And I might just add one thing there. Yes, in general, those are excellent suggestions. And if you could put a priority on you mentioned going to bed at the same time, waking up at the same time, the higher priority would actually be on waking up at the same time. Because sometimes we do, we do suggest to people as part of the therapy to wait until you're tired to go to bed. You know, make sure you wait until you're tired to go to bed. One thing, something that can sometimes happen to people is they're, you know, during the weekday, they're getting up a certain time and they try and make up time by sleeping in on the weekends. Well, the problem is if they're sleeping in till 10 a.m. when they normally wake up at, 6:30 or 7 on the weekday, then Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, they may find it much harder to fall asleep because their circadian rhythm has actually shifted a little bit.
Yeah, that's been my problem. I'm trying to be a little bit better about that. My problem is I get to the end of the week, I'm really tired. So on Saturday, I do not have to get up and go to work. But then you can get into all sorts of other problems by throwing off the schedule by sleeping in on Saturdays.
our brain certainly is looking for efficiency, for the best way to manage all the needs and drives that we have. And so if we give it consistency in terms of waking up at a certain time, it sort of has one less thing to worry about or to manage. And that makes other resources available to us to focus and to have energy and a good mood, et cetera.
All right. Well, let's take some other calls. We'll go next to Clinton, Iowa, I think, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have, excuse me, two questions. The first has to do with electronics, and really it's three parts. I've heard over time from both a physicist and a neurologist, two people that I really respect, and they believe that electronics interfered with the sleep process. And, A, for instance, they thought the worst thing you could do is sleep under an electric blanket. B, they thought that sleeping in a room with a lot of electronics activated interfered with your sleep cycle. And C, they also thought that if you had to work in an environment where there was a great deal of electronics going on in a confined area and you went home, that would interfere with your sleep cycle. Could you comment on those?
Yes, this is Dr. Davies. I haven't seen any studies to indicate that. So, certainly there may be some other things related to, light or noise disturbance. But if I understand your question correctly, you're concerned about essentially the electrical the wattage or the current being present, as you say, with the electric blanket. And I have to say that I have not seen any data to link that. In other words, to say that, for example, having an electric blanket or other other devices that are having current and wattage in and of themselves are disrupting or changing the sleep architecture. I might offer to you that certainly we have the hospital population patients who, for whatever reason, medical condition, have to be in the hospital, and certainly there are a number of different electronic devices that they have to be in contact or in close proximity to, and we there are other reasons that for sleep disturbance, but we haven't seen that to any significant extent in hospital patients, for example.
One other quick question in regards to sleep cycles. I believe it was on WILL, I believe, or somewhere on NPR, they had a piece on fasting to change your sleep cycle for people who did a lot of long-distance air travel. Hmm. And I wondered if you could comment on if, for instance, your job changed and you have to get up at a different time, what would help in changing your sleep pattern? And I'll hang up and take my answer on the phone. Thank you.
Yeah, that's certainly a problem for people who rotate shifts.
Absolutely. That's an excellent question. And jet lag, as well as what we call shift worker syndrome, conditions that we see fairly frequently. And in terms of fasting, I wouldn't say it has as great an impact as, for example, sunlight or bright light. And that can be a very powerful stimulant and modulator of the circadian rhythm. And it's been shown that people can relatively easily adjust their circadian rhythm by about an hour a day. So if, for example, you have to travel overseas, then and let's say going east, it might be helpful to actually simply try and go to bed earlier, a few days before you make the trip. So if you're traveling over 5 time zones, you maybe 3 days beforehand start going to bed an hour earlier, then the next day an hour earlier after that. Then you would likely only need to adjust a couple more hours by the time you get to your destination.
Okay.
So the light therapy, I think, is a strong modulator in that instance.
We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus, so we're well past the midpoint. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guests. We're talking here this morning with Dr. Charles Davies. He's a neurologist, and Dr. Keith White. He's a psychologist. Both of them work at the Carle Foundation Hospital Regional Sleep Disorders Center in Urbana, and we're talking about sleep issues. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to talk with someone in Bloomington, Indiana. And this is line one. Hello.
Hi. About going to bed at the same time and waking up at the same time, I've developed a kind of a staggered sleep pattern that seems strange even to me, but it works. And I'd like to get your reaction to it. I simply go to bed when I get very tired. Often I'll be doing a job, and being interested in the job keeps me from being fully conscious of how tired I am. When I complete the job, I become fully aware. I'm really tired. So regardless of what time it is, I go to bed. Now this will usually occur in late afternoon, but it can be any hour, and then I will wake up refreshed, often in the middle of the night. It'll be the middle of the night. So I get up, get right. Anyway, you know, it's in the middle of the night, and I work until I get tired again. It seems to defy, you know, normal body rhythms, the circadian rhythms, but I haven't had much trouble with, you know, these body rhythms, and I don't, is this healthy, and why don't body rhythms bother me much?
Sure. You raise a great point, and I think that this touches on one of the more overarching concepts, which is that as long as you're getting sufficient hours of sleep a night, it's not unhealthy. I would say that that's not a problem. And the most important factor is what works for you in terms of your job and or social commitments. So if this sleep schedule is not interfering with either of those things, I would say there's no reason to change.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll go on, and we'll go next to Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Sorry, I didn't quite plan that right.
Okay, that's okay.
I wanted to go back to apnea and the quality of sleep. I have multiple factors in my insomnia, but I'm also just recently diagnosed apneac, and I noticed there's a new screening device that people can take home with them to avoid the expense of the clinic, I understand, but it's not always effective, and it can give you a false negative in the sense that, from personal experience, my blood oxygen was not really that depressed, but the quality of sleep was still pretty bad. I have a brother who actually had an apnea event every 90 seconds and never got into level 3 sleep, much less up to 4. But so I don't know. I wanted you to talk about this new screening thing. I know a number of people who just don't have health insurance and can't afford to go to a sleep clinic, but if they could get pre-diagnosed, maybe they would actually know whether they are. Anyway, is that enough fodder for some
sure?
Of this course? No,
that's a good point, and I would say that probably the simplest and yet perhaps most reliable screen is simply having somebody monitoring your sleep. And if you are snoring during sleep, and if somebody notices you to stop breathing or even pause breathing during sleep, and you are feeling – you may feel tired during the day. You may not, actually. I think that is enough reason to have that further evaluated.
Well, the device that I'm thinking of, you – Velcro around your wrist, and it's basically just a blood oxygen monitor like you get in the hospital, only it's portable, and they can download the oxygen level and chart that out and see whether your hypoxia is so bad that you're you know, because apparently a lot of people sleep through their distress, actually.
Absolutely, yes.
So it's a quality of sleep thing as well as people, you know, right. Lying awake at night, which I think all of us do these days somewhat, but the combination is anyway. I wanted some more on the just the apnea I know the clinic. There are about 8 beds in town that do the clinic, so they're rather full up. And it seems that if there was any kind of reasonable pre-screening, and the idea of having somebody report on it, if they're a sound sleeper, they may not notice. All right, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you want anything further you want to say about sleep apnea and how it is treated?
Well, obstructive sleep apnea is being recognized more and more as a significant health concern. Actually, interesting little side note. Back in the 50s, there were some studies that came out trying to estimate the prevalence of narcolepsy, which is a kind of where people have sleep attacks and they may become weak, fall down with an emotional event. And they estimated the prevalence at a certain amount, let's say 5 or 10%. Well, it turns out that probably a lot of those people had obstructive sleep apnea, which can cause you to become very, very sleepy. So I think I just want to use that point to underline the idea that people with obstructive sleep apnea can be very sleepy and can have what some might term a sleep attack, you know, falling asleep in a conversation, falling asleep on the phone and things like that. But there's a great deal of variability. And some people, on the other hand, who have severe obstructive sleep apnea are not very sleepy at all. Now, those people may be drinking 8 cups of coffee a day to stay awake, but that is all part of the mix. But obstructive sleep apnea, which is a condition when your airway closes off when you're sleeping, basically initiates a response, a signal in your body to open up the airway. It's an arousal of sorts. But the person that's having it may not become fully conscious, may be having them frequently overnight and never realize that they're having the apneas. And so it can range from, you know, very mild to, as the one caller mentioned, his brother having one every 90 seconds. I mean, we see them even more severe than that. And they can be associated with significant drops in blood oxygen level because the airway can be closed for upwards of a minute at a time. Mm-hmm. So as you can – I mean, intuitively that sounds like a bad thing. And studies have shown that untreated obstructive sleep apnea can increase your risk for heart attacks and strokes. For example, a few years ago, a study looking at people over the course of 10 years, comparing people without sleep apnea and those with severe sleep apnea untreated, and the untreated people were basically, for whatever reason, they couldn't tolerate the treatment, although it was tried. And they found that there were roughly threefold increased risk of heart attacks and strokes. Yeah. So what do we do about that? The treatment is the most successful treatment to date has been CPAP, or continuous positive airway pressure, which is basically a device that you would wear while you're sleeping. It can be something that just fits under the nose or a mask. And it's essentially it's just taking air from the room, and a little motor inside the machine at the bedside increases the pressure in the air a little bit and acts as a splint, a mechanical splint, if you will, to keep the airway open while you're sleeping.
Yeah, and I know for a lot of people that has been almost a miraculous sort of thing, that it has helped them, and that now probably for the first time in who knows how long they're actually getting good quality sleep, and it has, I'm sure, a very enhancing effect on their life. Does it take long to learn how to sleep with? I don't know how much noise it makes, or I don't know what sort of discomfort might result from having to wear the thing or however it attaches. Does it take long for people to learn how to sort of habituate to that and not think about that anymore?
It does take a little time. I mean, there are some people that kind of, you know, take to it like a duck to water, so to speak. But there are some people that take longer to get used to it. And actually, that's Dr. White is also he has expertise in that as well. So I'll let him add something here.
Sure. Yes, I guess the first thing I'd say is that the folks should remain optimistic and positive and keep trying, and perhaps consult someone like me or their physician about the struggles they're having. Certainly, getting the right mask and the right fit for a particular person's facial structure, getting that all situated can be a bit tricky and takes some time, and folks should stay at that. And some people like the white noise. I have people report to me that the light humming soothes them to sleep. It triggers them to, boy, I'm going to get some really good sleep, to start thinking these kind of things. And yet we have folks that Have some challenges getting adjusted to the CPAP, but I have just a number of great stories, if we had more time, that I could tell about folks that would struggle with their CPAP and put it on the shelf and considered it something they just didn't want to tackle, who their physician or perhaps myself got involved, and we really encouraged them to try, and we helped them desensitize to it in a stepwise fashion. And I've had many patients now come back to me and say, boy, I can't live without it. It's my best friend. I travel with it. I can't imagine I went so long without using it. So folks should really work at it if they can. They'll really garner some fantastic benefits, we hope, and certainly people have.
Okay. We have time here, maybe about 5-6 minutes left. We'll get in as many callers as we can. We'll go next to Bloomington, Illinois, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I read a long time ago, or some time ago, that older people need more sleep. The popular thought being that they don't need as much. And I find that even though I'm very busy, now that I don't have time constraints, work and family, and that I do feel better if I sleep 8 or 9 hours. And at first I thought that, but it does seem to work. But the thing that really, really bothers me, and no amount of adjusting, I know you made some suggestions earlier, but there's these time changes that we go through every year. That is really, really hard for me. Hmm. I just wondered if you have any thoughts about either of those.
Certainly. Well, it may be that you were, as you suggested, you were just so busy in the past that you are a person that needs a little more sleep than the 7.5 hours that many people need. And now you're allowing yourself to get that, and and you're feeling better, and that's great. I think that's great.
Yeah.
But in terms of the time changes, bright light therapy can be very effective. And by that I mean there are devices out there, and I'm not going to mention any brands or anything, but essentially what they do is they deliver a prescribed amount of light, and it's either going to be 10,000 lux of broad spectrum light, full spectrum, or more recent data has suggested that light in the blue spectrum, but doesn't require as high an intensity because it's more efficient, 250 lux of blue spectrum light, and use that for about a half an hour in the morning when you wake up, and that acts as a very strong, basically it's something that anchors your circadian rhythm. It's an anchor of the circadian rhythm. It kind of wakes you up and then keeps you more alert. And as I suggested earlier, when trying to have good sleep and optimize your sleep, it's the most important thing actually is to try and get up at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the day and of course, if there's issues with insomnia, to try and avoid naps during the day. But the rest of it will kind of take care of itself. If you get up at the same time and use about a half hour of bright light, that, by the way, can even be with that, if you don't have the device, even just going outside, taking a walk on a sunny day, and even on cloudy days, there's certainly a lot of light getting through. I mean, that light on a cloudy day is actually more light than you're getting from your average light in your house. You doing that and then just going to sleep when you feel tired, that can be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Right. What's your opinion of coffee?
Well, coffee is one of the great inventions of mankind.
I love coffee, Dr. Davies, and it doesn't interfere with my sleep.
So I have to tread carefully here. And so what I would say is, for people who don't have problems with insomnia or other health issues, certainly sometimes there are cardiac issues that can be relevant. But if people who don't have any of those issues, no problem. Drink your coffee. Enjoy your coffee. But for people that have have insomnia, then caffeine is an issue, and they do want to try and minimize it.
All right. I want to thank the caller. Let's talk next with someone in Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Hi. I have two questions, one of which you touched on earlier. It's about white noise as a sleep aid. And the second question is about naps, the pros and cons of daytime naps.
Certainly. White noise, as Dr. White mentioned, can be very helpful, and we do suggest that when people are having difficulty falling asleep. And so naps, it's basically the pros and cons have to be in the context of what your situation is. Again, for somebody who's really not having any difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep, if they take a power nap or a nap in the middle of the day, that's fine. I would not recommend that somebody change that when if it's not broke, don't fix it kind of strategy. But for people who are, again, having insomnia, meaning difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep, and that's interfering with their daily activities, then one of the first things to do would be to cut out the naps, basically, because as Dr. White suggested before, it's a balance between sleep drive and drive for wakefulness. And when you nap during the day, that's going to diminish the sleep drive, and it will make it harder for you to sleep overnight.
Even if it's a 15 or 20 minute power nap.
A 15 or that's pretty short, certainly. If the 15 or 20 minute power nap is in the setting of having no problems falling asleep or staying asleep, I would say keep doing it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and we'll get at least one more here. Urbana, line two. Hello.
Oh, hello. I don't know if you covered this earlier. I tuned in kind of late. What do you think about taking Ambien and any long-term effects with that?
Well, maybe perhaps I'll jump in here, and Dr. White can also add something. Ambien is I think it's the most prescribed sleep aid in the country. I prescribe it all the time, and it can be very helpful. But studies have shown that for chronic insomnia, the behavioral strategies are more successful, can be more successful for resolving chronic insomnia than Ambien, and the behavioral strategies are what my partner here, Dr. White, does every day.
Absolutely, and certainly, I'm not against sleep medication by any means. It's been very helpful, extremely helpful to a great number of people, and very often, Dr. Davies or one of my other colleagues will start someone on a sleep medication so that we can get some solid sleep base happening for the person and give them a little more optimism and a little more sleep, so to speak, and then I will work with them over time, practicing how to wind down, how to relax, then how to manage their sleep overnight if they do awaken, and how to make the adjustments that are specific to their circumstances. And as Dr. Davies has said, the research has shown that over time, the behavioral strategies are going to be more effective. And in part, that may be because our brain is going to get used to anything we take in, for instance, caffeine or anything else we drink. So the same is true with sleep medication. Our brain will adapt to that. So it may not work as well over time, but the behavioral strategies routinely and regularly help us relax and get in the state that makes us more able to fall asleep and stay asleep.
We're going to have to stop, and I'm really sorry we have a couple of people we can't take. One thing I know that I can say, if you have access to the internet, there is a lot of good basic information available about sleep, and there are a lot of things, and they are the behavioral things that we've talked about, that people can try for themselves and see how that goes. But of course, if they have really serious problems involving sleep, then they ought to talk about this with their physician. We're going to have to stop with our thanks to Dr. Charles Davies and Dr. Keith White, both of them from the Carle Foundation Hospital Regional Sleep Disorders Center in Urbana. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Programs here on WILL made possible by the Beckman Institute, whose Thursdays at 12:30 concert series features performances by members of the University of Illinois School of Music in the Beckman Institute atrium. The Beckman Institute Cafe is open for lunch during the concerts. We will take a break for an update on the markets and news. Then we'll be back, so please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. Corn and soybean futures are lower. We're seeing that the marketplace and the commodity grain picks are being pressured by weak crude oil prices, as well as the mounting concern about the global recession that could trim demand for corn. And there was actually talk out of China today. A Chinese think tank has lowered its forecast of China's 2008 soybean crop by about 1 million metric tons. So we'll have to see how that plays off. There's also was talk today that China was purchasing two cargoes of soybeans, and we'll have to look for verification of that. Let's go ahead and look at the current prices.